Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Okay, good evening, everyone. I would like to actually start the evening by thanking our speakers of today's event and all of you for coming on a very cold day, either in person or online. We have many people actually listening to us at the same time. My name is Irini Moustaki, and I'm a professor in the Department of Statistics and Deputy Head of Education. I have the honor to chair this fantastic event organized by the Department of Statistics. There is a saying that a picture is worth a thousand words. And in our data-driven world, the power of visuals has never been more critical. Infographics, and I'm going to give a definition because I see some of my students here, and that makes me very, very happy, is a visual representation of information and data that uses graphics to communicate a message. Bridge the gap between complexity and clarity, turning data into stories and ideas into impact. They are vital tools for educators, policymakers, analysts, and anyone looking to communicate effectively. I will not, of course, give a historical account on informatics because my role here is not to give a speech. But while I was preparing to introduce our distinguished speakers, I realized that drawings on cave walls and the hieroglyphs in ancient Egypt are actually infographics that represents letters, words, you know, events, administrative records. And, you know, people that we know, like Leonardo da Vinci, produced anatomical diagrams and sketches combining scientific accuracy with artistry. People more known to us as statisticians like Florence Nightingale used statistical diagrams to advocate the healthcare reform during the Crimean War. Cartography and maps are also other examples on infographics. And the digital revolution with computational tools such as Excel and Tableau and Adobe Illustrator democratized the creation of charts and infographics are now found everywhere. So today we're very, very privileged to hear from one of the leading figures in data visualization, Dr. Federica Fragapane. Federica is an award-winning information designer and data visualization expert who brings data to life through stunning and meaningful visualizations. Her projects have been featured internationally, including in prominent publications like Scientific American, and she has collaborated with the United Nations, the BBC Science Focus, Google News Lab, Penguin Books, and La Lettura. She uses her expertise to illuminate everything from scientific discoveries to societal issues. Her work invites us to see data not just as numbers, but as stories waiting to be told. Her work carefully selects visual languages to encourage readers to engage with real-world problems, like migration, environment, and other social matters. In 2023, the Museum of Modern Art in New York acquired three of her data visualizations for its permanent collection. Federica will be joined by two discussants, Dr. Marta Foresti and Dr. Francesca Panero, and the three of them will take us on a journey through the fascinating world of infographics, exploring different aspects and their impact on addressing real-world problems. So before I give the floor to Federica, I would like also to introduce the two discussants. So Marta is an LSE alumni and the founder and CEO of LAGO. There are a lot of acronyms in which is a local action on global opportunities, a research and creative collective on migration, culture, and the arts. She's also a senior advisor at the Moleskine Foundation and a senior visiting fellow at the Overseas Development Institute, which is an independent think tank on international development and humanitarian issues. Marta is a prominent global development, migration, and governance expert with extensive experience in policy research, advocacy, and social justice initiatives. I must also add, during my searching for the speakers, that Marta has also studied dancing and that the dance has influenced her work. Finally, Dr. Francesca Panero is an assistant professor at Sapienza University in Rome and a visiting fellow in the Department of Statistics at the LSE. Her research focuses on Bayesian statistical methods, particularly complex networks, assessing disclosure risk to safeguard privacy and exploring fair machine learning algorithms. She also contributes to applications like food insecurity prediction, and she's also involved with the Grantham Research Institute on Climate Change and the Environment at LSE, reflecting her interdisciplinary approach to statistics and social challenges. a little bit of the logistics. So after Federica gives her talk for about 30 minutes, each one of the discussants will talk for 10 minutes, and then we will open it to Q&A. Please join me in welcoming Federica as she shares insights into the art and science of infographics. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. I hope you can hear me, and I'm very glad to join you this evening, even if not in person. So my name is Federica Faragapane, and I'm an independent information designer. And tonight I want to talk about data visualization, visual languages, and alive visual worlds. And I'm going to explain later what I mean. This is a synthesis of what I do. I visually translate numbers, contents, and information into visual representations. And I want to show you a few examples of my projects. And usually the range of complexity that characterizes my projects can be very broad according to the needs, the usage context, and the readers. And I'm going to show you some examples of different usage contexts and different levels of experimentation. One of the projects that MoMA acquired, it's called Space Junk, and it's for the magazine BBC Science Focus. And I wanted to show it to you, and I want to show you very quickly to start showing you my process, how I used to overlay different levels of information and complexity to display information. In this case, the project was about the junk we live in space. And this was the dataset I was starting from, screenshots from the dataset. I had information about the number of objects orbiting Earth, the mass in tons, their distance from Earth, and BBC Science Focus wanted to display all these different levels of information. And I want to show you how I overlay them. So you can see that on the left part of the visualization, there are different distances from Earth that were the ones categorized by the source. And then on the bottom part, there are the different types of objects. What they wanted to display, what BBC wanted to display, was the number of objects orbiting Earth at the indicated distances. So at first, I showcased the distance as the length of the lines for each category. And then to indicate the number of objects at the indicated distances, I use the area of a circle. And I use this code for all of the objects and all the distances that I had. I add then as information also the macro categories of objects as another layer of information. It wasn't the most prominent one, so I displayed it with the color, with three different colors. And then I add the mass in tons. They also want not only the number of objects, but also the mass in tons. And then I visualize this data as the thickness of the lines of the different distances. And finally, the source also provided some trends, historical trends for the different categories of objects. And so I also display this data, this information. So I showcase this project because I wanted to show how I usually overlay different levels of information when I work on complex visualizations as this one. But I will show you visualizations that only have one number or a couple of numbers behind them. Another collaboration I have is with La Lettura, that is the cultural supplement of an Italian newspaper, Corriere della Sera. And for instance, I work with them for a column that is called Visual Data. And again, it's a data visualization column. And in this case, also in this case, we display complex information, multi-layered visualizations. And there is always an important aspect I have to mention when I talk about this collaboration, and it's about the usage context again. La Lettura is a cultural magazine published during the weekends, and those are the photographs shared most commonly by La Lettura's readers on social media. La Lettura next to a cup of coffee or a tea or a brioche in a context that suggests as reading. La Lettura is part of a lazy and relaxing Sunday morning. It's published on Sunday. Working for a daily newspaper would be very different for me. In this case, I know that the usage context allows me to work on pieces that need more time to be read in their complexity. In this case, I want to show you quickly some examples. I'm not going to explain them in detail, but I worked on a very wide variety of topics, such as population density. This is a visualization about the masterpieces of Piero della Francesca, so also artistic topics, cultural topics. And when I work on this kind of visualizations, when I work on this kind of projects, I really see them as the visual equivalent of a long article. For me, it's really like writing with visual alphabets. And I experiment a lot with visual letters. And this is why for me, it's very, very important providing the readers with all the tools to use such alphabets. So this is why for me, designing the key, the legend of the visualization is essential. And I dedicate a lot of time to the visual explanation of the project with very short and simple sentences. There was a misconception when I started working in this field, more than 10 years ago, there was this misconception about data visualization that was a good infographic doesn't need text to be understood. But I don't agree at all, and many experts don't agree at all. Because at school, we learn how to write, we learn how to read text, but we don't learn how to read graphics. And there are papers that demonstrate how even the simplest graphics, the ones that for me are super straightforward, can be misleading for a reader who is not an expert of the data visualization visual language. So for me, combining text and visual representations is always important. And of course, it's even more important when the visual languages that I choose are more experimental and less conventional. I want to show you another project. Talking about context, this is another context, a different one. And it's an exhibition. I had the pleasure last year to work for a photographic exhibition in a beautiful museum in Turin called Galleria d'Italia. It was a photographic exhibition by photographers Luca Locatelli, curated by Elisa Medde, and it was all about circularity, circular economy solutions, and environment and sustainability. And I've been commissioned some data visualizations to accompany the exhibition journey, because the intent of the project was had a strong informative purpose, and they wanted to enrich it with data visualizations that accompany the exhibition journey in the different rooms. And for them, I designed an interactive screen and some static data visualizations. The interactive screen was developed by my colleague and friend Paolo Corti. And I want to show you one of these static data visualizations, the last one actually, the one that closes the exhibition. So there were different topics covered. And the last one that closes the exhibition was about a beautiful project called Project Drawdown. It's a list created by a collective of scientists that are periodically updating this data set, that it's about all the possible solutions to reduce concentrations of greenhouse gases. And you can see this is a screenshot from the website. There is a list of solutions. The solutions are categorized by sectors, and then they provide the information about how much they could help in reducing the greenhouse gases according to two different scenarios. And I want to talk about this project because it allows me to explain how also the selection of data, of quantity of data to be visualized, it's part of the message itself. In this case, this was a project, as I mentioned, that closed the exhibition, and we really wanted to close the exhibition with a positive message, the presence of a multitude of solutions, and the richness of possible solutions, and this is why I wanted to showcasing all of them, not oversimplifying in this case. So I designed a branch, one for each solution, as you can see. And then I plotted all of them, visualizing them in a unique visualization. And you can see it's full of branches. And then I categorized them. I visualized the different macro categories they were grouped into, as you can see. And finally, I added the information about the reduction, how much they could help in reducing emissions. And so, as I was mentioning, this is a visualization full of branches, full of elements, full of information. If you consider it in a museum context. And this is because we really wanted to provide this message, how many the solutions are. So even the choice, as I was mentioning, of the quantity of data to be represented, it's really related to the message, connected to the message that I want to display. And I'm going to show you later some projects that have just one number behind them, because sometimes there are cases in which, on the contrary, just one number is enough. I want to talk a little bit about aesthetics and the role of aesthetics. So aesthetics has a really important role in my design process. My main purpose is communicating. And for me, aesthetics is not just a matter of doing final retouchments in the final phase, final embellishments, but it's really part of the process I want to work on. For me, working with care on the aesthetics of my pieces is an invitation. It's like inviting the readers to spend time looking at my projects, hopefully that it can be a pleasant experience, even when the data I'm telling are not pleasant at all. So it's really an invitation for me. And I think that as in writing, choosing the visual words in speaking is essential, of course, according to the needs and to the context and to the people we are talking to. I think that the same concept can be applied to data visualization too. There are cases in which I use classical representations, classical visual words. If we think about the world of data visualization, I use bar charts, I use trend lines, graphics that are more commonly associated with the infographic fields, because there are cases in which it makes total sense to do it. For instance, I collaborate with the publication office of the European Union, and when I work with them, it makes sense for the context to create very classical and minimal representations. But then there are cases in which I work with organic and soft shapes. And this is a definition of organic, relating to or derived from living matter. And I often deal with data that have a living presence behind them, human lives, but not only human, this living and organic presence behind them. And for me, working with soft and organic shapes, it's a way to remind myself at first, and then hopefully the readers, of this presence, that sometimes it's hidden behind the numbers. For instance, another project acquired by MoMA was this visualization. This is a visualization I designed for the magazine Atmos, and it's part of a brilliant investigative piece by the journalist Yesenia Funes. She wrote this piece about environmental defenders killed in Brazil. And she asked me to accompany her article with a visualization showcasing the number of environmental defender deaths in Brazil by state during the years. And she asked me to create this visualization using an organic visual language, using a specific look and feel, because she thought that it could be a good way to accompany her work and to display such topic and such data. And I mentioned the usage of the term alive to define the visual words I work with. And I not only mean they are alive because they are organic, but I mean it in a broader sense. So there is a quote I really, really love by Toni Morrison, author and Nobel Prize winner for literature. And she's talking about the risks of a rigid and unchanging language. And she wrote, "Unreceptive to interrogation, it cannot form or tolerate new ideas, shape other thoughts, tell another story, feel baffling silences." She was talking about the written and spoken language. But I think that the same concept can be applied to data visualization too. I think that we always need new visual words to shape other thoughts, to tell other stories, and to fill baffling silences. For instance, the usage of a certain look and feel is not only related to the contents of the data, but sometimes to the data themselves. Some time ago, a client of mine used this adjective to describe my projects as fragile languages. And I have to say that I really liked his definition. I want to show you an example. For is the International Elimination of Violence Against Women. And some years ago, I decided that I wanted to do something about the topic. And I created a visualization to be displayed on my social media, showing the percentage of women who have experienced physical and or sexual violence from an intimate partner at some time in their life. Of course, I looked for this data from official and reliable sources that provided the data for all the world's countries. And I visualized all of them using this shape in which one line equals to 1%. And so it's proportional to the percentage. And I visualized the data for all the world's countries. And this information, the percentage of women who have experienced physical and or sexual violence, it's an information that will be inevitably inaccurate, because we are going to lose, we are inevitably going to lose stories and testimonies and reported cases because of the very nature of this information and on the context. So even if the source, of course, is reliable, this information will inevitably be incomplete. And I think for me, a way to try to display this inaccuracy, a way to talk about it with intellectual honesty, it's also using languages that are not necessarily perfectly geometric. Here in this case, I didn't want to, for instance, allow a super precise comparison among the different countries, because that was not a point. I just wanted to provide an overview of such a dramatic situation. And the fragility of the shapes for me is a way to reveal also, hopefully, the fragility of the data themselves, of the data collection process themselves. Data, of course, aren't neutral creatures. And they bring with them errors and mistakes because they always have human behind them. And of course, I'm not the only one who talk about these aspects of data and information. And for me, the visual languages I work with are a way to try to show this fragility too. At the same time, of course, I think that display this information is extremely important and helpful. So of course, I'm not saying that these data are not important to be shown. I think that for me, it's important, it's relevant to display them, also thinking about their fragility. And thinking about unreported cases, this was a concept that sticks to my mind for some time. And this is why then, years later, for the same day, I decided to work on unreported information, unreported cases. And I visualized some data about the barriers to reporting sexual violence. The paper I extracted the data from provided different categories of barriers, individual ones, so the fear of being blamed, interpersonal barriers, so for instance, lacking power to report because of the relationship with the perpetrator, sociocultural barriers, so the fact of not feeling protected by societal institutions. And so I think that it's equally important working with the data that we have, but also questioning the data that we don't have and questioning the reasons why we don't have them. I want to talk about another project of mine. This is different from the ones that I've shown you so far. It's old, it's from 2016, but it's here one of the projects I'm most fond of. And it's a visual narrative of six asylum seekers' routes. It was 2016. I live in Italy, so there is a lot of talking about migration. And I was frustrated by how the topic was dealt with by media and, of course, by politicians. And I thought that I would have loved to use my competencies to talk about it, but sharing the experiences of the people who are living it and using my tools, data visualization, to do it. And so I went in a welcoming center in my hometown in Northern Italy, and I met a volunteer who worked there. I told her about my idea, and she replied that she had already a group of people in mind who could have participated into the project. And this is how I met MB, SS, MD, AL, SG, and TK. They are six asylum seekers who had arrived in Italy a few months prior, in the summer of 2016. And this is how I worked on a visual narrative of their journeys and their experiences. I met them. We had different interviews in the welcoming center they were hosted into. And we reconstructed the routes point by point with the help of Google Maps. And for each point, I always ask them the same questions. How many days they traveled to get there, which was the transportation, and how many days they stayed there before moving to the following place. Plus, I added that I would have noted down any additional comment or note they would have liked to add to their narrative, but only if and they wanted to in that case. So after our meetings, I started working on the project. I knew that I wanted to work on six personal lines. And I created a language to display the information that I was collecting. So the lines are shaped by the journey, by the lived experiences. And then I displayed the days spent traveling with a very simple horizontal line. Blue line for the days of stay in the city, and a light blue one for the days spent traveling. And then I displayed the different transportation with different dashed lines. And the final project, it's a website created in collaboration with my super talented colleague, Alex Piacentini. I'm not a developer, so every time I need to work on interactive projects, I need the help and support of developers. And in this case, Alex is also a UX, UI visual designer. And it's online. It's a website. It's called storiesbehindtheline.com. And in the landing page, the first thing that you can see are the six lines with the initials of the six narrators. And then clicking on them, it allows to go to access the narrator's page. And the first thing you can see is only a black path on a white background. These stories are very precious and very unique. And I really wanted to make sure to give the lines their own space, showing only the line on the white background. And then interacting with them, when with the menu, of course, allows to read the data, to see the data, to read them, the information about the transportation or the day spent traveling. The red dots that are pulsing are the moments in which the narrators decided to share a more detailed fragment from their journey, and clicking on them allowed to read them. There are lines that are full of red dots. There are lines that have no red dots at all, because that was depending on the narrator's sensibility and willing to add some more qualitative information to their story. And then, of course, it's possible to see the map behind the lines. I hope you can see it properly from the screen. I'm not 100% sure, but there is a map, trust me. And you can see it online. You can watch it online. And for me, it was very important to showcase the line only in the map only in a second moment. I wanted to show, I wanted it to be a discovery for the readers. And I wanted not only to focus on the Mediterranean Sea route, that is the part that many Italian media most frequently mentioned and still mention, because of course it's extremely dangerous, but there are, before that part, there are thousands of kilometers and hundreds of days spent traveling, so I wanted to showcase all of them. And talking about the look and feel, it's very different from the other ones. And for me, first of all, it was related to the narrator's style. I really wanted to reflect their style. They talked about such painful and dramatic experiences in such a quiet way, and calm way, a minimal way, that I really wanted to talk about it with visual languages, but using the same minimal, the same style. And also I think that this migration topic is subject to a spectacularization by the media that undermines a clean approach and a clear narrative. And in this case, I really wanted to use very simple and clean representations. And then I think that the narrator's comments allowed me to add an incredible emotional layer to the project. A beautiful comment is the one by SG, who was 26 years old at the time, who arrived from Pakistan, and at the end of our meeting told me, "My mind is quiet now. I am quiet because I'm safe, and that's why I love Italy." And another beautiful comment is the one shared by AL. He was 17. He crossed part of the desert on feet. He lost many friends. And at the end of our meeting, he told me, "You have a beautiful life here because you know that you're safe." I will always be grateful because they decided to trust me and to share with me their precious and dramatic experiences. So I've kept working on the migration topic for years. It's something that I'm still doing. With Marta Foresti, I've started doing it in 2020, and this is how we met. This is how we started collaborating and working together. She was working at ODI at the time, and it was 2020, March, April 2020. And she, with ODI's team, was starting to collecting stories of migrants' contribution to the COVID-19 response. And they had created this periodically updated database. And she contacted me because she wanted to bring these stories to life. And this is what we did. We create a website. It's called Key Workers. in which we created these trees, one for each geographical area. And the trees are made of different branches and have different fruits. The branches represent different sectors, such as agriculture or healthcare. And the fruits are the single stories. In this case, we didn't want to provide a point specific, providing insights or how the stories are categorized, for instance. But we wanted to create a space in which the readers could just help themselves and exploring these stories, these important stories of contribution. This is a project that was then periodically updated for years, actually. And it really helped me understanding how the language of data visualization can be important also to keep a topic alive, to keep the light on a topic, not only in a single moment, but to keep it alive periodically. And then she founded LAGO, LAGO Collective. And with LAGO, we are working on visas and visas inequality. This is a visualization I created with Marta Foresti and the data analyst Otto Mantegazza that explores rejection rates of short-term visas to Europe. Here we are talking about short-term visas, so visas not for people who want to change their lives, but for people who need to travel for work, for tourism, short stays. And we analyzed with data about the different countries grouped into different GDP groups and rejection rates. And what emerges from the analysis is that the group of low GDP country with an high rejection rate is the bigger one. So the poorer your country's origin, the most likely your visas will be rejected. And the contrary for the high GDP countries. We are working on this topic. We are trying to give shapes to this topic too. And this is something that we are keep on working and we'll keep on working. So I want to conclude the talk with another kind of projects, another set of projects that again have different characteristics and different usage context. So until a few years ago, I didn't create projects specifically for social media. I use social media to share details from my projects. I'm a freelancer, so I need people to know my work. But I didn't work specifically for Instagram, for instance. And then something changed, and I want to talk about how data visualization can also be a tool in this sense. So it was October 2022, and I was following with a lot of interest. And also a certain level of emotional connection, what was happening in Iran after the protests in Iran that followed the killing of Mahsa Amini. And I was following what was happening there. I was reading a lot, but I wasn't doing anything from my job perspective. I was a little bit afraid to do performative activism. So doing something about a hot topic just for the sake of doing it, and then just leaving it and then thinking about something else. So I didn't design anything. I wasn't designing anything. But then one morning I saw a lot of Instagram stories from an Iranian colleague, Maral Purkazemi. She's Iranian and German. She lives in Germany. And through her Instagram stories, she started telling how important it was for the people there in Iran that people outside Iran would have talked about what was happening there via social media. And she really was writing, please don't be afraid to do performative activism. Just do it because people there need to know that we are talking about it outside Iran. Use your tool to do it. And then after reading and watching her stories, I decided that I wanted to do something about it. And what I often do when I want to talk about a topic is to look for data online, for numbers. And in that case, there was this number that was the number of people who had been killed since the beginning of protests. It was October 2022, and when I worked on the project, the number was 133. And there was a gesture I was very obsessed with, and it was the one by Iranian women who were cutting their own hair, their own braids, in sign of protest. And this is why I decided to draw this braid, in which one hair represents one person killed. And I share it online. I share it on social media. And I was extremely impressed, not only by how much it was shared, but especially by the number of direct messages I received from Iranian people, the Iranian diaspora. They wrote me a lot, and they asked me to keep on working on this project, to periodically update it. And I didn't plan anything. I didn't plan to have a periodically updated project. It's something that I did pretty instinctually. And this is why I consider this project a collaborative one, because the idea of keeping it alive came from these people. And also every time I published a new update, they reshared it. And during the months and the years, actually, because this is a project that lasted years, I started recognizing from the profile picture the people who were part of the project, because they always reshared it. And this is why, as I was saying, I really consider it as a collaborative project. So the next update I did was some days later. At that point, the source provided another information that there was the number of children who had been killed at the time. And so I displayed this information as displaying it as with white air, white lines. And then I kept on updating, as I was mentioning, for months and for years. At a certain point, there was another information to be added. It was the one about the protesters who had been executed. And I visualized this information with purple lines. And this is the last update, that it's from January 2024. Working on this project and reading the messages from the people from the Iranian diaspora really made me understand how data visualization can also be a tool to keep topics alive and to an instrument for other people to share the visuals, to share the information, and to for themselves to keep it alive, to keep on talking about topics that are dear to them. And so I kept on working on numbers that, again, sometimes somehow obsessed me. And one of these numbers is this one, is the number of days that have passed since the Taliban banned teenage girls from school. The first time I worked on this number, it was 500 days. The latest update shows that there are 1,000 days have passed. And learning what we do at school, it's learning, first of all, how to read, how to write, how to count. And I think that such a number without access to education is a number that deserves to be counted, to be written down. And this is why, in this case, I visualize it creating this spiral made of the counting, writing the number of days, 1, 2, 3, 4, up till 1,000. Because I really think that this is a single number that deserves to be counted and displayed. And another number that I wanted to work on was this one. In January, I was reading this report from Oxfam saying that Israel's military was killing Palestinians at an average rate of 250 people a day, which exceeds the daily death toll of any other major conflict of recent years. And I tried to draw this number. I hand drawn the shape made of 250 branches. I also had the information about the number of children killed. And when Oxfam published the report, more than 100 days had passed since the beginning of the attacks. And this is why I replicated this number, this information, more than 100 times, to try to give a shape to this data, to this information, and to what it means. So that's the end of the talk. I wanted to show how I try to use the visual language of data visualization in different ways for different contexts. My main goal, my main objective is always communicate somehow. And this is what I try to do and I want to keep on doing. Thank you very much for your attention.
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ ask social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Hello, everybody. Hope this is working. I think so. So thank you very much for being here or online. Thanks to LSC, my former academic home, to Irini, Giulia, Penelope, and the whole Department of Statistics for helping out, and of course to Federica for a great talk and to Marta for accepting. So my role here is to be the nerd. No, you wouldn't tell, but that's like deep down it's my reality. And I'm going to talk about uncertainty in particular. But before doing that, I want to tell you how this PLP was born, at least for me. So I think it dates back to 3 years ago. I was at the International Book Fair in Torino, and I was at this book presentation by a data journalist, Donata Columbro, presenting her book about how to explain data to a lay audience. And you might not recognize her, but in the panel there was Federica. And that was the first time that I met her and I got to see, got to know her work. And so, like, I really liked the presentation, the book, the idea and everything, but I felt like I was a bit out of place there. Like, they were talking about data, and I'm a statistician, a mathematician, but there were no quantitative people in the panel there. Talking about, like, let's say, degree level. They were, like, journalists and designers, and which is, like, perfectly fine. But then somebody in the audience asked to the writer, so how do you deal with quantitative people when you're telling, like, you know, stories about data? And she replies saying, oh, you know, I tend to avoid Twitter nowadays because whenever I publish there something about my work, somebody's going to tell me that I'm not formal enough, I don't use the right notation, I don't check the assumption, and everything like that. So, like, I felt a bit depressed. I left and I felt like, oh my God, am I so boring and annoying? Like, is my category like that, really? So it didn't occur to me until, like, 10 days ago, really, but I think, like, this PLP was kind of like me trying to answer to that feeling. So this is the nerd part. I want to talk to you about uncertainty. If you know a statistician, you might know that we are kind of obsessed with that. Why? Well, because, like, whenever we ask a question, somebody asks a question, and then we need to answer to that using some data, like, the hard truth is that most probably we're not going to be sure about the answer. So there's always a margin of error when we're talking about data. And, like, in certain contexts, it's especially, like, important to acknowledge that. So don't just, like, give a number, but listen to me while I'm trying to say how, like, certain or uncertain I am about the answer. So why does that happen? So whenever we collect data, so think about, like, census, surveys, cookies, social media apps, like, every second we're leaving data around, these data are full of errors or uncertainty. How? Well, for example, we might make mistakes recording them. Let's say that you got your, like, Fitbit, Apple Watch, whatever, and sometimes it runs out of battery, then you're dead if you just look at the data, but you're definitely, most probably you're not, okay? So that's a mistake, we might want to account for it. People might lie, which is especially true in, like, for example, election polls, when people might feel ashamed to say who they're voting for. And finally, usually data cannot really cover the whole population. So our best hope is that the people that I'm asking to my question is, like, represents well the variability in the population. So let me make an example. Let's say that I want to estimate how tall on average the people in London are, and I'm going to ask you, you're my sample, okay? I record the data and then I take an average. Do you think you, like, represent well the variability of the people in London? Well, not really. I mean, there are no kids in here, for example. So you're like a bad sample. So me, the statistician, need to do something to correct for this uncertainty. So somehow, like, take into account the error that I'm making. So I hope you realize by now that if the question is important, especially when we're talking about, like, public policy, like Marta will do later, it would be great to be able to quantify and represent this uncertainty. Don't get me wrong. This is a really hard task. Like, I mean, we're talking about quantifying something that we cannot see. Sometimes we don't know about, like, what's there that I don't see? Like, the rest of the population of London that is not here tonight, unfortunately. So let me make you some examples where I think we can quantify well and represent it well, and then some others where we need to think about something else. So on the 6th of November, I woke up, and I discovered that Trump was winning by a lot. And I remember that I felt like, oh my God, like I didn't really read the post that well, but I think they were saying that they were 50-50. So I went online and I was like, so how did the post do? And if you read this article by The Guardian, for example, they're saying that, guess what, like the polls did like a terrible job again trying to predict the triumph of Trump. And I was like, okay, so is this true? Is this what was actually happening, what the polls were saying? I look a bit further and I stumble upon this article by this, I think it's a blog, like talking about like politics and data, 538. It's a very, like, very good one. And this article was published on October 30. And so look at there, it says Trump and Harris are both a normal polling error away from a blowout. So I told you that we're never sure about when we're talking about data, okay? So you should never expect a poll to make a 0% error. Actually, like a great poll would have like a 3% error would be considered a really good result, okay? So what these people do was to try to simulate many outcomes of elections and try to represent the uncertainty that was coming in from the polls. So how did they do it? They took all the data from the polls and they simulated like something like, let's say, 50,000 elections. How did they do it? So every time they were like choosing an error. So they were saying, okay, we're going to take the data from the poll and assume that they are correct. So 0% error. Or we're going to assume that they made like a 1% error in favor of the Democrats or a 2% error in favor of the Republicans. And then they simulate many elections and they saw in these simulations who was winning, and then they represented it. So how do you read this graph? So let's look at the tie there. So it means that on this axis, the x-axis, it means that every column represents the simulations where, in this case, the popular vote was tied. So Harris and Trump were tied on the popular vote. The height of the bar, which is around like 2,500, is the number of simulations in which both like Harris and Trump were tied, okay? So out of these like 50,000, 2,500 were tied. And then you see that the bar is made of different colors. So around like 1,200 were simulations in which Trump was winning by a blowout. Around again like 1,200, it was a Trump slim win. And then like around like the little blue part was this like kind of like 100 Harris slim win. So if you look well this plot, what I see here is that the dark red and the dark blue, which mean like the percentage of simulations where Harris and Trump were winning by a blowout, it's actually bigger than the light colors. It's like 60% more or less. So this means that if you took into account the error that the polls could have made, which was like perfectly reasonable, like the story of the 50-50 was not really telling us the full picture, okay? So it's not so surprising that Trump won by like 312 seats, so by a blowout. It was actually like way more probable. That was, again, October 30. So I hope you agree with me that like, this is a quantitative and visual representation of uncertainty. Of course, you need to be able to read it, or like at least, you know, read the article in order to figure out how to, as Federica was saying, like we're not taught how to, you know, we don't learn how to read graphs that well. So it might take a while indeed. Sometimes though, I argue that there are cases where quantifying uncertainty, it's a big mess. Like especially in what Federica said about, you know, fragile data. Fragile for me could mean that these are data that are really, really hard to collect. And or like dangerous, for example. And in those cases, or talking about like some very delicate topics, in those cases, like quantifying uncertainty might be too hard of a task. Like we cannot do it, okay? We might be hopeless. In this case, I think qualitative representation might be preferable. So I took an example from Federica's work. So this is, she's plotting here the estimated population density in Rafah before October 2023, in December, and then in February 2024. So how is she representing uncertainty here using, as I'm saying, like more qualitative representations? Well, she partly already said that. So she's using these organic shapes that resonate to us as like human beings in a different way from like using a bar. I could use a bar plot to plot this, but it wouldn't give me the same sort of feeling, okay? So I think that's a way to acknowledge uncertainty. And the other way that, like, I didn't realize for, like, actually a few minutes after standing, like, and looking at these plots, is that there are no numbers. I have no idea what's... I mean, I could count those, like, little dots, but that would take me ages. So I feel like it's not that there were no numbers at all. Like, on Instagram, she posted this together with the caption, so she took this from the BBC News, so the numbers were in the caption, but really, like, I feel like not putting it in the picture is a way to acknowledge how uncertain it is, this sort of data. Like, people were not, external people were not allowed to go, like, we couldn't, like, really run the census there. So you can imagine, like, how big of an uncertain, like, how big the uncertainty is behind this data. I want to conclude. I didn't put a conclusion slide because I'm still thinking about it. I feel like, as I told you, organizing this was a way to put together, like, people from both a quantitative and a qualitative background to talk together about how to represent data and, for example, visualize the uncertainty. I think really, like, humans, us, we live somewhere in between these two words. So, like, putting people together, talking about this and how to, like, we can effectively represent data and uncertainty, I think it's the way forward, really, to, you know, like, talk together and figure out how to do this together. Because, I mean, like, there's a lot of psychology also in the way people perceive data. And, like, you know, I'm a statistician. I never studied this thing. So I need, like, somebody to tell me and figure it out. And that, of course, like, eventually my hope is that, like, academics paper are going to have these visualizations. So somebody's finally going to read them and not just us. Okay, so that's it for me. And thank you very much.
Okay, thank you everyone for still being here. So we had the superstar, Federica, we had the nerd. My job is to make sure you walk away with some food for thought, something that a bit disturbing in a good way, something that makes you want to do things a little bit differently. I'm going to say three things, and I actually need to keep this phone next to me because there is a piece of knowledge that I have to search up. And I'm going to spend a couple of seconds on the first two and quite a lot more on the third. The first thing I want to say is how absolutely beautiful Federica's work is. I worked with Federica for a few years now, and every time I see it on a screen, I'm blown away. And there is something about what Federica said about the role of aesthetics in what she does, which is incredibly powerful, about the production and the, you know, what we all walk away with and what it lives in us and how important that search for beauty is and how unique in this work is and how not distant it is from knowledge, from data, from research. The second thing I wanted to say, which I think is very self-evident, is that this is terribly urgent work. From Rafa to Iran to everything I've done with Federica on migration, we are talking about urgent policy issues, unresolved, thorny, wicked problems, sometimes researchers call them, that we are all grappling with. And then the third thing I'm going to say, which relates to the first two and is the one that I really would like to get your thoughts on, is that this work is terribly underrated, is misrepresented and often misunderstood. And that undermines all the potential that it has, particularly given the urgency that it brings with it and the absolute beauty that it offers, that has so much to offer to all of us as a way of inspiration. So let me tell you more about what I mean by underrated, misunderstood, and misrepresented often. And it starts with the way we talk about this, right? We talk about something called infographic data visualizations. My feeling is that we interpret this in a very limited way, typically around this idea that this is about representing data. Okay, there is knowledge, there is data, there is truth, and then there are wonderful people like Federica who have a special craft and they turn that into something beautiful, interesting, colorful. That is not what this is about in any way. And I find, I mean, it's very difficult to find the right way to define this, but I certainly find the notion of information design and design as a process of inquiry, and I'll come back to it in a minute, as what has been my experience of this work and the potential that it has. So I would like all of you to walk away thinking that there is a lot more that we can all do with this and engage with. And the reason why I think this is underrated and underestimated and misunderstood, let me try to sort of persuade you, thinking about two areas, one that has just been mentioned, policy, and then I'll end with some thoughts on knowledge, and might end up being a little bit nerdy myself at the end. Policy is what I do. I've forever researched policy issues, and I've always worked as an applied researcher, in particularly in public policy. Migration has been one of the issues that I focused a lot in my sort of the last part of my career, and that's, Federica explained to you, that's how we met. So I was literally sitting at my desk at the computer in March 2020 in London. I'm originally from Milan. Milan was shutting down, was already shut down, and it was clear that what COVID was provoking was going to be a major cataclysmic problem. Here in London, there was a debate about what to do, about whether to close or not schools, and whether schools should remain open for the children of key workers. And so as somebody who works on migration, I got very interested in this idea of key workers and whether we could, you know, look into the role of these key workers that so often are obviously migrant workers. And the result is what Federica showed you, and this beautiful work, key workers that we've worked together on. And that's how I literally picked up the phone. To this date, I don't remember why I knew who Federica was. I think I saw some of her beautiful work and I was inspired by it. So I looked her up. And I emailed her and I said, listen, and I sent her that list. And that list, okay, the researchers in the room, that list is a cut and paste of clippings from newspapers around the world telling stories about the fact that there were refugee nurses who were coming to the rescue of some emergency wards in the States, you know, policy reforms to allow migrant workers to work more hours to, you know, to contribute to the response and all that. So it was as messy and as uncertain as uncategorizable as they get. So as a researcher, I didn't know where to begin with turning that into a proposition. And that's how I found Federica. And it's by what, you know, that work, it's like turning those, that list of links, that mess that would have been like, in the old days, would have been clippings of a newspaper on the corner of a desk, turning that into a piece of work that, as Federica said, lived on for a number of years and created, you know, and contributed to a really important policy narrative about the value and contribution of migrant workers in the COVID response, was, as a policy researcher, invaluable. It is by far one of the most influential pieces of work I've ever been involved with, because it allowed me to explore uncertainty, to explore, you know, reform areas. You know, as you can imagine, come the summer, all the debate was about how do we create, you know, how do we adapt visa regimes so that, you know, agricultural workers can stay longer. How do we create, in Italy, there was a major reform around irregular work that involved, you know, included very controversially different categories of migrant workers. So we're talking about live policy issues. By definition, policy deals with uncertainty. And here I was discovering this incredible, powerful tool that allowed me to depict uncertainty, to collect that information in real time, to keep it up to date, and to keep the conversation going, and to take that conversation into the V&A in Dundee, to take that conversation into, I can remember, Federica, some awards that we won on some kind of industry standards for design, like all sorts of places where that policy conversation wouldn't have happened otherwise. So I was blown away by the potential of this inquiry of design that came with it. Another element of policy relevance, think about, I mean, we talk about the migration, after about 2-3 minutes in a conversation, somebody says, we really ought to change the narrative, right? We really ought to shift away from the way people talk about migration. Think about the vocabulary and the images that we've been exposed to in migration conversation, how many arrows we've seen, how many invasions from the sea, how many deaths, how many desperation, how much desperation. And then think about those trees and how we, you know, what Federica said about the use of organic metaphors and ideas to create something different. The power of that language when talking about something like the value of migrant workers is, has immense policy cachet. Like, it's literally something that you can, it's not just that the image speaks 1,000 words, it's that it speaks a different language, and it takes that different language into this, you know, into potentially new circles. And this is where there is, for those of you who work at the interface of policy, it astonishes me that we don't use this more as a tool, as a way to actually engage policymakers and talk about very real life policy issues. Final word on policy time, whether it is Iran, the work on Afghanistan with the words that, you know, counting the words, you know, our trees that grew and grew for a number of years, how challenging it is to keep a policy process in question alive over time and to be able to learn from it is a forever practical problem of everybody involved in policy advisor and policy making. Again, information design has immense potential to, in a much cheaper way than sort of, you know, for those of you who are statisticians, than some sort of big, large N studies or, you know, multi-year, sort of multi-year and complex statistical analysis can. It's not replacing it, but can you see the fact that there is a way to capture that time function in such a pragmatic and powerful way? So this leads to my considerations of knowledge. This is not something I had been thinking about, but I was mostly going to talk to you a little bit about this policy dimension. And I was thinking, obviously, the reason why this has this potential for policy and policy making, of course, is the knowledge it carries and what it does with knowledge. And I think what Francesca presented is a perfect example of, you know, when you're navigating a space of knowledge that is complicated, that is difficult, that is uncertain, that is messy, and then, you know, the need to interpret it and do something with it. And then I almost, you know, when you literally connect the dots, I connected a few dots, including the building we're in and the school we're in, where, of course, there's been a long tradition of philosophers looking at the nature of knowledge and understanding knowledge and uncertainty and finding ways to assess validity and to, and to create coherent and meaningful knowledge and describe, for example, in relation to scientific progress and scientific discovery. And then I remembered that I knew through a friend that one of the fathers of what is today infographics is actually Otto Neurath, who was a philosopher and a thinker on sort of on logic. And very much in the tradition that then philosophy of science and epistemology is very much part of the tradition of the school, who thought about what is called isotype, so this way of simple Pictorian figures that try to represent, you know, size and number, not by blowing up the picture, but by repeating in a way that is consistent and coherent in a series or in a, you know, in a combination of figures, the problem at hand. And how much of that you can see in today's Federica's work, in her, you know, in her work on Iran, on the repetition. This was Vienna, 1920s and 1935. And we had, you know, a group of philosophers engaged in trying to understand the nature of knowledge and how important representing knowledge and the limitations of language to represent that knowledge, coming up with something that is incredibly reminiscent of Federica's work in the 20s and 30s, precisely to represent and truthfully and meaningfully and honestly representing the realities of, for example, you know, that, you know, revealed by a less than perfect poll. And so my final thought, and this was a nerdy bit, is then perhaps we can come back to some of that, right? We can come back to that fundamental, almost a heuristic power of information design to interpret reality, bring it back to the heart of inquiry, including, you know, research and academic inquiry into statistics, probability, philosophy, economics, and really forget, put it, you know, once and for all, stop referring to this body of work as research communications or somebody that comes along, take our data and just makes it look terribly pretty or persuasive, and really bring the knowledge power, the power of inquiry of this body of work into the heart of research and knowledge production. I think this is a fascinating area of work. So all of you, particularly that are students, I really encourage you to embrace it, but also all of you that work with policymakers to really not just, you know, take the data visualization along, but actually engage with designers in developing policy relevant work using information design. Thank you.
Thank you, all the speakers. That's been a fascinating, actually, talk by Federica. Thank you so much. And it's really pity that you're not here with us today. But I think it's time for questions, and we can take some questions from the audience and then some questions if they are online. Anybody who has a question, we have two microphones here.
Thank you very much. I'm a researcher of both qualitative and quantitative methods, but I use more qualitative. And then the figures look really amazing. It's really nice how you picture them through natural petals and this kind of plants. But I would like to ask you whether you could recommend some software that the other researchers could maybe try to apply. Thank you.
Okay, let's take another question as well, and then maybe Federica. So the first question was about software. But, yes, you can also maybe introduce yourself. Sorry, I forgot to say.
Hi, my name is Kane Dantanis. I'm an economist. That was a brilliant. I thought that was a brilliant presentation from all three. I have a question for, well, I guess for all of you, but mainly for Federica. So obviously, in your visualizations, you use natural shapes and figures a lot, leaves, these kind of things. Leaves, flowers, trees, branches, these kind of things. And obviously I work in a much more sterile area. We tend to use bar graphs and line charts and that's it. And so my question really comes to, from your experience, what is the added value of these aesthetics that you bring to the data, like flowers and shapes? Does it engage people? Does it increase the emotional impact of your visualizations? Yeah, I'd love to hear it.
Thank you. So let's take one more question from the audience. Okay, we'll take one question here. Thank you.
First of all, thank you so much to all the speakers for this very interesting talk. I'm interested in, because you cover a lot of very difficult topics, deaths and, migration, etc. Where when I'm looking at this, the next question, of course, would always be, okay, so what could be a solution to it? So you visualize kind of the problem, but I would be interested in when people then look at the graphic, how could we maybe also integrate kind of the next step? That we are then taking, where is the link between data visualization and action for you, especially Federica? And then also the topic of making complicated data or hard data or maybe hard to digest data look beautiful. There's this paradox in that as well, where I feel like also when it comes to climate change, for example, how can we visualize carbon maybe in a negative or positive way? Those two questions.
I think we can take these three questions. Federica, were you able to hear the questions?
Then
maybe. Thank you.
Okay, so first of all, thank you for the questions. The first one about softwares. I use Adobe Illustrator and the suite Adobe, but there is a software that I use a lot, which is RawGraph. RAW graph, which is great. It's online, it's free, and it's great to create static data visualizations. If you are going to look at it, it's full of different representations, and I use it pretty often to create the macro structure of my visualization. So you can just copy and paste or upload your CSV files there. Then there is Data Wrapper. Data Wrapper is another great tool. I don't use it because it can also be used for slightly interactive visualizations. I don't use it because my interactive charts are super custom, and in that case, I collaborate with developers. But it's great because of the possibility it offers in terms of customization and design. And plus, it has a great blog learning section with tons of super insightful resources in terms of notation, accessibility, colors, how to use color, how to make your visualizations more helpful, engaging, and accessible. So it's something that I definitely recommend, Data Wrapper. So about the second question about the added value, First of all, I have nothing against bar charts. As I show you, I also use bar charts. And I think they can be very, very helpful and very useful. But for instance, I remember that when I posted, one of the times which I posted the Iranian, the image about Iran, there was a comment that was saying, oh, this could have been a bar chart and you could have been compared, you could have compared the number, the total number of killed people and the total number of killed children with a simple bar chart. It would have been more effective. How can this be more effective, actually? I mean, how could you think that comparing these two numbers with a bar chart can be one helpful, two effective? We really have to think about what effective means. And I think this is an answer. In that case, I didn't want to compare the number of children who have been killed with the number of adults that have been killed. I wanted to create something that could resonate with people, that could make them want to share it. Also because of its aesthetics, because for me, aesthetics is really a tool. So I think that there are cases in which these organic shapes and these visual languages I work with can help me in hopefully in having this kind of engagement with the people I want to talk. Also for the exhibition, for instance, the exhibition about climate solutions and climate and circular economy solution. It could have been all a bar chart. Most of the projects I do could be represented as bar charts. But then think about a visualization full of bar charts, 5-6 visualization flow bar charts in a museum context. I don't think that with the people, with the visitors, it would have been the same impact. So for me, it's really about the impact that my projects have to the readers. And I don't want to force it again. I think that there are cases in which a bar chart, a trend line, is the best way to display information. And for instance, this is why in the project about migration, I showed the day spent traveling with a bar chart because I wanted to use a very simple visual language. So I don't want to force it necessarily, but there are cases in which also I would say instinctually for me, it makes sense to use shapes that can have also a sort of emotional connection with the people I want to talk to. And finally, the last two questions, I visualized the problem about how can we act? For instance, let's talk about the climate solutions, the visualization about the climate solutions. That was a visualization about how can we act. In that case, I wasn't visualizing the problem. I was visualizing the solution. So sometimes we can also visualize the solutions. And I couldn't show you all the branches in detail, but something that I really love about Project Drawdown is the fact that you can see solutions that are more on a systemic level, industrial level, but there are also individual solutions that are pretty easy to make. For me, for instance, changing in the diet, something that are solutions that are at individual level. So sometimes the solution is within the visualization itself already, and I often display urgent and dramatic information, but when I can, I also want to display the solution itself. And then I think that for me, sometimes some of these visualizations, the one that talk about the more urgent topics and issues, I mean, it's like a way to sometimes to make people discover something new, because sometimes some information are not necessarily accessible to everybody. And maybe seeing them in a pretty infographic can really help you in understanding something new. And then discovering something new can lead to action. For me, this is what is really important. I don't want to tell anybody how to act. I really have no, this is not something that I want to do at all. But for me, it's important to let people discover something new. And then hopefully this can lead to action. And finally, the paradox about having beautiful, thank you, shapes and very dramatic topics. For me, it's really something important to work on. I often work with very ugly data, ugly information, dramatic information, and I display them in a pleasant way. And this is my way of dealing with them. I would never say it's the only way to do it. But it's, I think that it's really related to my personal approach to visualizing such data. For me, working with a lot of care to visual elements that can be also aesthetically pleasant, it's a way to it's my way to pay an homage to what these topics represent from one side, when I talk about people losing human rights or using their own lives. For me, it's a way to respect them and to pay homage to them. And let's think about climate, for instance. For me, talking about something that is so scary as climate change, and the fact that this is so scary, makes it a topic that many people don't want to deal with and want to ignore. For me, treating it with visually pleasing shapes, it's again a way to try to invite people to look at it, even if the information that these shapes are telling are scary and want to and can be intimidating for readers and for many people. So I hope I was you're satisfied by the answers. Thank you for your question. They were very interesting.
I know we're kind of running out of time, but there are a couple of questions from the online audience that I would like to take. And one is the obvious one. I mean, how is AI going to affect, you know, the work that you're doing, or infographics more in general?
I don't know. I mean, I'm curious. You know, at the moment, I'm using AI in a very boring way. I mean, I'm just using ChatGPT as secretary because at the moment, there are not very interesting implementation for me. Let me tell, I mean, I'm curious. It's a tool. So I'm curious to use it as a tool. With AI, of course, we have to be extremely careful and critical with all the possible bias it brings. So the critical approach for me is essential. I don't know, maybe it will steal my job too. We'll see. At the moment, I haven't seen it as an interesting tool to use, but just for a matter of implementations with the other instrument I deal with, I think. I'm open to use it as a tool with a very critical glance to it.
And there's one other question that is maybe useful for the students who are also here. How long does it take to, or how many iterations does the typical visualization go through before you finalize it?
So, of course, it depends on the kind of project. But let's say key workers, for instance, the one we did with Marta and ODI, it was pretty fast because we started working on it in April 2020 and it was published the first version was published, I would say, maximum a couple of months later, 1 or 2 months later. There are projects that, some of the statics projects, I would say some weeks, 3-4 weeks, not full-time. I never work full-time on the same project because I had different projects going on. And then there are very long projects I've been worked on for 1 year. I would say that the interactive ones usually are the longest ones, also because then there is the iteration not only with the clients, but also with the people I collaborate with, the developers I collaborate with. So this is the range. 1 week to 1 year. I know it's a very wide range, but I mean, that is how it is actually.
So there is also a question from a policy analyst from the OECD in Paris. So we have people from Paris listening. And the question to you is, what are the major challenges you faced when collaborating with international organizations, for example, the UNEP, and policy experts in general? And would you have a takeaway for us, he's asking, or she's asking.
So thank you for the question. I'm thinking about it. I've been very lucky because the collaborations I had, especially the ones in the last year, are from people who trust the way in which I display information. So the main challenge when I started working into this field more than 10 years ago was that it was a trend creating infographics, and people asked me for infographics even if they didn't need it. So those were the worst cases in general, because then I created something with a very few data, but then it wasn't actually needed, and then the outcome was disappointing for everybody. So that was the worst scenario ever. I would say that the challenge is the trust. So trying to balance what I can do from an experimental perspective with the needs. But this is something that I try to understand since the beginning. So every time I work with a new client or potential client, I show them different projects. Some of them are very classical and minimal and simple, and some of them are the most experimental one. And so for me, the first important aspect is talking with them about how much they want to experiment or how much they want to stay classic. And I have nothing against staying classic. So this is the main aspect that I want to clarify at first. But I have to say that in the last years, I've been very lucky because I worked with clients who really understand the potential of this tool. And this is something that is really important to me, doing it because there is really an understanding of what this tool of data visualization can do.
Now I think I'm going to take one more question from the audience. There's anybody? There was a lady. Yes, thank you. There's a microphone.
Hi, so my name is Gabby. I graduated from LSE last year. I'm now working as a data and reporting officer for the UN. So I'm kind of coming with a similar question to the previous one, but maybe one more directed towards Marta, because obviously for Federica, as you said, if they're coming to you as a freelance designer, they already understand the value of these kinds of visualizations. But Marta, I'm imagining at ODI, that's not always the case, and maybe you have to advocate for doing something like partnering with Federica. So I'm curious about how in these kind of INGO, think tank contexts, how you get people who aren't already maybe sold on the idea more compelled by these kind of visual languages for data.
Thank you. And actually, this relates a little bit to the questions on bar charts and to some extent the added value. You show it by doing it. There was actually, interestingly, COVID was a really interesting moment because it was this moment where, you know, the better known path, like the traditions of working through the normal tools of doing a piece of research, then doing an event, you know, people in the room, including places like ODI, you know, had to change. And similarly, where museums that were just showing beautiful work could not do that anymore. So there was this moment where everybody had to change a little bit the ways of working. And that's, interestingly, that's when Key Workers was born. And it was literally a funder that would have funded, if I remember well, I think it was a foundation that were going to fund a series of policy briefs and engagements across Europe. That was not going to happen. And they said, well, use the money differently because we need to rethink. And that's how... So it started like that, but it's a little bit what Federica said about the problem with people wanting an infographics they don't need to really show the value of a piece of work that has actually knowledge and where knowledge grows and where the inquiry that goes with it can produce solutions that maybe have not been thought about. And the other thing that is very simple is that this work has the potential for outreach. So the fact that you can say to a policymaker that Key Workers has been exhibited at different museums is only last week, I think Federica had an interview in Abitare, I think, and there was a big, you know, a nice picture of it. So the idea is that if you've got work like this that gets shown and reaches audiences that wouldn't normally be reached by, say, policy briefs or other tools, it has potential for policymakers because it creates awareness, it creates, you know, a conversation, a discussion, or certainly some that understand that. And I think this is all important for all of us, and this is the question about the added value. The way I think about it is, what was the added value of what I was doing before? Like, what was the added value of all these reports or all the bar charts? The behind the visa visualization. There is a wonderful scatter plot that shows very clearly GDP and rejection rates, and is crystal clear. In fact, it's clearer than the visualization in terms of the inequality, particularly for African countries. But it's then when you take that story and you take that story to someone else, it says actually you turn that into a shape of inequality, and to your horror, we also now turn it into the sound of inequality. So we turn the data into a sonification, which actually is not as clear as the original scatter plot, but together tells the story of this visa inequality in a very comprehensive way, not just emotional, actually. So it's a little bit the showing it and showing the potential that I was referring to before, almost like going a little bit beyond the representation of pretty, you know, the pretty representation of data, and to really, you know, show how much longer it lasts. How much it's incredibly cost effective. Incredibly cost effective. The shelf life is much longer than a research report that is updated, you know, 3 weeks later. So it's really to be quite. But yeah, COVID was a moment because it everybody started to think about doing things differently. And that's where, for example, it was possible to do things with museums that museums themselves had never thought about before. Well, they did in 1930, I realize. Neurath was also curator, but not recently. So that's the idea.
Thank you, Marta. And I think at this point, I think we have to close the event. And thanks so much, Federica, for this inspiring and exciting talk. And I mean, I don't know, the work has so much impact. And Marta and, you know, Francesca, the way you talked about it, I think there are courses that we can take on infographics. And Federica has 2 courses online that, you know, you can do as well. And I'm so now looking forward to do one myself. So thank you all very much for being here tonight. And there is a reception afterwards.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favorite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.